If you're a cannabis business owner looking to expand into new markets and need guidance and support you can trust, consider Collateral Base, a group that has done it before in multiple merit-based and limited market states. Collateral Base was founded by an experienced cannabis attorney with highly educated consultants with master's degrees and years of experience in the cannabis industry. The Collateral Base team is confident they know cannabis licensing better than any of their peers. And I encourage you to see for yourself. It just takes one phone call. If you're ready to expand your cannabis business into new limited markets, contact Collateral Base today at 309-306-1095. That's 309-306-1095. Or visit collateralbase.com. Hey, music lovers. The Cannamom Show podcast, in collaboration with Lambkin Guitars, is giving away a custom-built, one-of-a-kind electric guitar built by Josh Lambkin. The solid one-piece hemp wood body includes a built-in glass bowl piece. Yeah, you heard me right. You can take a hit and then play a lick. Now's your chance to help the Cannamom Show crush cannabis stigma with your entry. Register for the Hemp Guitar Giveaway online at lambkinguitars.com. That's L-A-M-K-I-N guitars.com. The drawing will be part of a 420 celebration at the Goods Dispensary in Somerville, Massachusetts, where the guitar is on display for the month of April. But don't worry, you don't have to live in Mass or be present to win. Visit lambkinguitars.com to scope out the hemp guitar giveaway details and entry form. You'll even find a video of what could be your guitar in action. lambkinguitars.com.
Everything is personal right here. Everything is personal right here. Everything is personal right here. Len and John rolling it up, listening as they change the industry.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to another episode of Everything is Personal. Today we have a very special guest with us. It's Laurie Parfit. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, this will be fun because you've been around the industry for a while. So there's a lot of questions that I want to kind of dig into with you and your expertise. But before we do that, I want the audience to learn a little bit more about you and sort of your background. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town called Glencoe, Illinois. It's in the northern suburbs of Chicago. And I've been in Chicago my whole life, except college.
Got it. And then were your parents together? Do you have siblings?
Yeah. So my parents actually still live in the house I grew up in. And I have a younger sister, and she lives in the UK. She lives out near Cambridge, and she's an ultrasound technician.
Wow. In the UK, it's interesting. Yeah, my parents still live in the same house I grew up in Philly, so... I don't know.
Well, and the best part is my father actually grew up a block from where I grew up. Mm. So my father's been in Glencoe since he was 5 years old. And he's turned 75 this past year.
Wow. So everybody, it's like a small town. Everybody knows each other, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but it's like a suburb. So we're surrounded by a lot of other towns. But right. I always used to talk about the fact there's only about 8,000 people in Glencoe specifically. Mm-hmm. And when I was in high school, I would always talk about how I would get in trouble whenever my mother went to the grocery store because she would bump into the other moms and they would all talk about things. And whatever somebody said, she'd come home and get upset with me for it.
That's funny. So what kind of kid were you? What were your interests? Were you into sports? Were you music? Were you just kind of, how would you describe that to somebody?
I was more artsy. So I loved art. I loved crafts. I was entrepreneurial as a child. So I loved creating things. I would make hair bows, earrings, jewelry. And I would walk the streets. So my mother actually is a CPA, and she used to work at this little office in Highland Park, Illinois, which was one town over from where I grew up. And I'd go to work with her, and I would walk the streets with my hair bows. And I used to go to the local businesses in Highland Park, and I would present to the managers to see if they would carry my products.
That's super cool. I did the same kind of thing that my daughter. I remember there was this whole trend of duct tape, like things with duct tape the kids were making, like they'll make bookmarks, they'll make this. And I was consulting this big corporate office, and she came with me to work, and she made these duct tape, like I said, bookmarks and all these kind of things, and she walk around and sell them to people. And then one day she made like $114. I was like, wow, super entrepreneurial. So yeah, that's a really good skill set to have. So being an artistic kid, when you were going, was there like, did you want to be a certain, like, I want to be an artist, or I have a certain profession, or were you not sure you weren't leaning towards anything specific?
So when I was much younger, I wanted to be an artist, but my parents told me that I needed a backup plan. And so what I was really interested in growing up was fashion. And so I wanted to be a fashion designer, a merchandiser. I thought it would be so fun to be part of that world. And the truth is, I went to college for merchandising, for fashion merchandising. And I just never moved to New York or Los Angeles. So there really wasn't a lot of opportunity in Chicago. And I ended up utilizing the part of my major that was more consumer packaged goods, grocery oriented, and did a lot of merchandising on that end.
Got it. So another like alignment of synergy. I wanted to be in the music business, not a musician, just in the business of music. I was like Rick Rubin, and I'm like, I don't know, they don't play instruments, and but my parents said I needed a backup plan, so I went to physical therapy school instead. not even close. At least you can leverage that. But because you know, sort of what my company does now, having a good knowledge of anatomy, physiology does really help with that. So it's not all waste. So when you went to school for that, and then you got into corporate, you said it was CPG, but on the food side, was that correct?
Well, my story starts even before that. So I did the merchandising management major at Michigan State. And I loved it. I worked for Nordstrom all through high school and college. I did my internship at Bloomingdale's in New York. But then out of college, I decided that I didn't want to do what my major was in. I wanted to try something completely out of my wheelhouse. And I became a financial advisor and trader for Morgan Stanley.
Interesting.
So I actually spent the first 8 or so years of my career in finance. So I was with Morgan Stanley. I started with them 2001. I was actually part of their class that was in the World Trade Center on September 11th. And so that kind of disrupted our program. And it was a little bit different of a path there for me. Coming out of Morgan Stanley, I went over to CNA Financial. They're a big insurance company based here in Chicago. And I did their investor relations, rating agencies, regulatory, FP&A, so financial planning and analysis. And then I went over to Kraft Foods, and I started in finance at Kraft, and then they transitioned me over to more of a sales and marketing role.
It's really cool because it creates a much more rounded sort of approach to what you're doing today. And we'll get to that, because looking at the numbers, I mean, there's a lot of disconnect, especially in the cannabis industry, as we'll talk about, between, oh, I want to be creative, I'm going to make this amazing brand, but numbers should be driving some of those decisions. And I think you having that background in numbers really helps, and a creative side, I think it helps bring those two together.
Yeah, I would agree. I got really lucky that I was given a lot of these opportunities. And so, you know, with all of those years in finance, and then when Kraft, the funny there story there was, Kraft usually doesn't move people between silos. So your finance all the way up, your sales all the way up, your marketing all the way up. And the sales department was looking for people with financial acumen. They felt the same way, that people want to get creative, or they think it's, you know, all show. But the truth is, you really need people with financial acumen to manage trade budgets and do consumer trade marketing and understand, you know, shelving assortment and what the data, what the analytics are saying from Nielsen and IRI and all of those companies. And so they had an initiative to bring over people with financial acumen. And so they requested from the finance team, anybody have anyone who has good financial acumen, but also could potentially have good sales and marketing skills? And I was lucky. My senior director raised his hand and said, I got one. And they threw me over.
It's the unicorn. We have a unicorn.
And the rest is kind of history. And so I was there, and then I was at Beam Suntory doing sales strategy and distributor management. And then, you know, over to Topco Associates, a private label product cooperative, running their business unit. So running full P&L responsibility, ideation to implementation at store shelf. And that was another company where they didn't have a lot of those controls in place. Very old school. They procure on behalf of their cooperative. They procure on behalf of the grocery industry. And there were no business cases created. They would just create things, not determining whether they were profitable or not. And so I was able to put a lot of that process in place so that the creative team, the project management team didn't get so backed up with everything, that actually everybody had to create a business case with financial data before a project got approved.
So novel.
I know.
It's interesting because, so I started my corporate career at Price Waterhouse, and then I was there for the PwC merger and acquisition, but I was in the management consulting side, and I found it really interesting because after the merger with Coopers, I was placed into the marketing department. So I'm the only guy, and it's all women. And as you're talking about this, I'm like, well, this is a company that is a numbers company. Like, they do numbers, except for their, you know, fucking up the Oscars. They're pretty good with numbers. But, you know, and we'll chalk it up to an anomaly. It just happened once. It happened that there was a billion people watching it. But it's okay. It happens. But I remember sitting in these meetings with the marketing team, and we were discussing things like color theory. Like, what colors will evoke different emotions, fonts, and all these different things. So how every single business unit had to develop their own website. And I mean, this is 1998, maybe. So yeah, I'm aging myself. So it's 97.
Oh, no,
maybe.
You're in my world.
it's going back a few years. So I was done college in 94. And then, but nobody ever talked about, well, when we do these things, what do the numbers say? It wasn't like that. It was a complete disconnect from there. And I find it fascinating how decisions, marketing decisions, you know, branding decisions are made without data, and without not only data helping them make those decisions, but actually tweaking those things based on the feedback data that comes back. So that's a really unique perspective, but it really should not be a unique perspective.
No, it's one of the fallacies about marketing. People think it's all creative, it's all fun, we're all colors and building out target personas. And we do that, but it has to be grounded in data. So even when I do brand strategy and I build out a target persona, whether I'm creating Sarah or Megan or John, I'm still doing a ton of consumer research. I'm looking at the analytics to see who these people are, how they trend. Everything that we do in marketing should be grounded in data. And then you're right. We should be looking at all of those analytics and making data-driven decisions. If something's not working, that's fine. Don't double down on it. Don't continue it. Cut it off. Let's try something new.
Yeah, it's important to fail and learn from those mistakes and just move in. Too many companies continue to squeeze, and it's like they're creating friction. This isn't about my company, but just one of the things that we made a decision on in my company this year specifically. I actually talked to our customers, and one of the things that I sort of had a gut feel about, but I didn't really get direct feedback, that some of our customers felt that we are competing with them because mm-hmm. we have a DTC product as well. And they're like, it's taken us so much more effort in marketing to differentiate ourselves with our branding from, you know, your company, your brand, because people can buy the same product. Why is ours different than yours, kind of thing? And it was just sort of this aha moment that said, we have to stop doing direct-to-consumer sales because we rather have channel partners. Let's do everything. Let's change our entire strategy of marketing. Let's prop up our channel partners, because if there is a consumer that wants to buy a DNA test, let's have a drop down. These are our partners. Buy it from one of them. So let's help them, which will in turn help us, instead of sort of competing with them. And I'm not even sure why we didn't think that before.
Well, sometimes it just takes somebody telling you that that's an issue. And so that's a common problem that a lot of companies have, that they do the business to business side, and then they do the direct to consumer. And when you have that, you will have your customers upset because you're competitive with them. Mm-hmm. We see it on the retail landscape all the time, especially, you know, in apparel and things like that. And so when you take a look at some of the apparel brands that are out there, some of the ones that you see in a lot of these stores are ones that don't sell direct to consumer. They only sell wholesale. And that really helps them leverage their partners better, as well as manage those relationships more effectively.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when was the sort of, how do I even say this? When did you come out of the closet as a cannabis person that said, you know what, I am going to focus on cannabis and take all my skills that I learned from corporate and bring it into this crazy industry?
So I am a swing for the fences kind of person. I am a high risk, high reward. In corporate America, I never actually felt like I fit in. I was always the misfit, the maverick, the redheaded stepchild. Everybody, you know, I have a background in finance, sales, operations, and marketing. And everybody could see value in that, but nobody quite knew in corporate America what to do with me. And so I always felt like I got, you know, these projects that nobody wanted to do. I got these areas that nobody wanted to be in, which ended up being great for me because I'm a creator and I like creating things versus just doing a job. However, I had a mentor that I'd worked for at the private label product cooperative. And after I left there, I went for 5 years to MissCon America, helping them start up Ragu and Bertolli pasta sauces after they purchased it from Unilever. And I had kind of run my course at MissCon. I was there 5 years. I could do my job with my eyes closed. I was done within a couple hours a day. There just wasn't a lot of runway there for me anymore. And my mentor came to me, and he actually came to me to get a reference for a job. And I was like, oh, tell me about the job. And he said, it's in the cannabis industry. And I said, that's amazing. That sounds like a wonderful opportunity. And it was the president of Forefront, who had Mission Dispensaries, and he went over there. I gave him a reference, and within the month, he called me and said, how would you like to come over and head up all of marketing and customer experience for us? And as I said, high risk, high reward kind of person, and I love a challenge. So I jumped over there. And I jumped over there 5 years ago at a time where it was still a little dicey. People weren't so sure about the cannabis space. I even had friends who didn't want to talk to me anymore. I had moms that that were on my daughter's skating team that didn't want to carpool with me, that basically thought I was a drug dealer. And but I had found my place in the world.
I mean, it's so incredible because I went through this very similar experience. And to go back to the corporate experience, so I'm going to try to paint a visual for those of you that can't see me. I obviously am follically challenged now, as you can see. I don't really have hair. But back in those days, in the grunge days, I used to have really long hair, earrings, and all that stuff. So going to work at corporate Price Waterhouse, I had to put my hair back in a ponytail, wear my suit. I never felt like I fit in, even removing that, because of the various backgrounds, that this creative part. Numbers aren't really my favorite thing, but you know, I still have to look at that, and understanding sales and biz dev and marketing and having this wide background, I always felt my entrepreneurial spirit. And moving into cannabis, and when I actually used coming out of the closet for a reason, it's because of that specific reason, because people would be like, drug dealer, drug, all these different things. And I used to be the president of the Cannabis Action Network. So when I came out, you know, waving the flag big time, and all these people started turning on me. But the irony is, a lot of them started coming back and saying, I have this, I have that. Now, can you help me with that? You find the same thing?
Yeah. There were people who wouldn't let their kids play at my house. And now those same moms are asking me what they should be taking and how they should consume responsibly. And can I go to a dispensary with them and help them? It's amazing how it shifts.
Yeah.
But it definitely has. But back when I joined, it was still a little wild, wild west. Yeah. But for me, it was like coming home. It's like finding your perfect match. So like when you think about finding your spouse or your life partner, they say that you just know. Mm. And I never believed that until I met my husband, and I knew right away. And I felt the same thing when I joined the cannabis space. I had found my place in the world. I had found my purpose. And I really felt like I was at home. And one of the things I loved about the space, very entrepreneurial, and you could jump into whatever sandbox you wanted to. Everybody wanted help.
Yeah.
So the fact that I could do finance and ops and sales and marketing meant that I could jump into all those sandboxes, good, bad, or otherwise.
Well, I was going to ask you how you find the cannabis industry different than like the corporate industries that you were in. And I think you're answering that now without me even asking the question, but is it because the industry is so new? Is it because it's the most regulated, unregulated industry that we have? And is it because the people who initially got into it don't have, like, either they're people who came from the black market who know how to grow and sell cannabis,
or it's people who came from corporate that said,
I'm going to join the Green Rush, but I never even consumed plant.
Is there this middle ground that makes it so exciting for people like you that have this various background because of the difference in the newness of this industry?
Well, that's a big part of it. I mean, it's exciting. It's fun. Mm-hmm. I like what I used to call sit in categories, alcohol. I've done alcohol. I've done tobacco. I've done it all. So to me, that's kind of fun and interesting, but it really plays into that entrepreneurial spirit. I always say that, you know, I see a lot of my colleagues from CPG and alcohol trying to get into the space, and they're very corporate. Yeah. And the corporate executives that are really successful in the cannabis industry are generally scrappy. People who didn't have a lot of resources, who had to do a lot with a little, which played into my background perfectly, because like I said, I was the redheaded stepchild. They used to throw me into places nobody wanted to be. They wouldn't give me resources. I had to figure out how to do things all by myself and get it done. And so that's how I've lived my whole career. People who work for a major CPG and have, you know, a $50 million marketing budget on their brand struggle in the cannabis space because they're used to hiring agencies and they're used to big teams and lots of resources. So for someone like me, who's entrepreneurial, who can do a lot with a little, who wants to get their hands dirty, it's really exciting. And we're building the industry, like it's building the plane as it's taking off. Yeah. So that's part of what's exciting. And so people who like ambiguity and like to create, this is the perfect place for that. So this is a create a job, not do a job. So even in the biggest of the cannabis companies, you don't come in and just take over for somebody and just do a job. You really have to create something new and unique as you go into each role. And that is what I find so inspiring about it. Additionally, it's the being able to be part of a movement, being part of something bigger than yourself. Cannabis truly is a movement. One of the first things someone said to me when I entered the industry, and I say this a lot when I speak on behalf of the cannabis space, is he said to me, what we do now will affect the industry 10, 50, 100 years from now. So don't screw it up.
Yeah.
And that's just stuck in my head every day. And everything that we do, every step that we take will affect how this industry operates 10, 50, 100 years from now. They're going to look back on all of us and say, how did we do this? Just like we do now with alcohol. How did that come out of prohibition? How is cannabis coming out of prohibition? It's a very exciting time to be in the space and to be part of something that is so interesting and unique. And we might never see anything like this again in our lifetime.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with you on that because there's so many different factors. Like if you look back on the beginning of this industry, so with the Prop 215, SB 420 in California, where we had, you know, AIDS, cancer patients, the medical patients. So we stand on the shoulders of the people that, you know, came before us, the risk takers that really stood out there and really fought for this. And then it was, maybe we were the second round that came in right on piggyback on them. But we always had this thread of like a cause-based industry. You mentioned alcohol, tobacco. There's no medicinal benefits in no. those, but we have a plant that it can be similarly, you know, sold and distributed like alcohol, tobacco. It can be a pharmaceutical product. It can be a nutraceutical product. It can be a wellness product. All these different things, but there's still a cause. And the reason why I bring this up is I think there's a shift in the market that happened. And I think the shift may be financially motivated. There may be some greed. There may be some people who want to cash out. But it really hurt our industry. And it hurt our industry from, you know, the availability of funding. You know, aside from the nonsense with scheduling this plan and all that other stuff, I'm just talking about the industry as it is disseminated through different states and all these regulations. But this need to go and make this law for recreational cannabis. Okay, you created this product, and I remember in California because I sat with Lori Ajax, who was the cannabis czar way back when. And I had this conversation early on with her, and I was telling her that we have patients that have a hard time finding their medicine and what works best for them. And she, I can say that her name because she's no longer that person, that role, but that conversation was, you know, between you and me, she said, this is not medicine. And I was like, you're making decisions on
you know, on a legislative and laws and all these different things, and you don't have a connection and understanding that this plant is therapeutic. And long-winded way to ask a question is this shift of recreational. How do you think it's impacting the entire industry as a whole and siloing this lack of therapeutic purpose of the plan, this cause that we actually all fought for?
So even when I came into the industry in 2019, I was medical. My dispensaries were all medical. And medical and cannabis in general is about helping people live better lives. It's wellness your way. Being able to decide how and when and why you are going to treat yourself from a medical perspective. And no matter how you look at the industry, whether it's medical or recreational, the need states, the occasions are still the same. It's just, there's a difference in the consumer path to purchase, to be honest with you. So when people say, I just want to get high, that's not just wanting to get high. That is stress relief. That is still a medical need state. Anxiety, still a medical need state. Sleep, still a medical need state. Athletic recovery, all of it. And so at the end of the day, it's still a medicinal plant. It still has therapeutic value. You're correct. And obviously the recreational side of the business is much more lucrative now. But we have to remember where we came from. We have to remember what our roots are. Is that we started this all to help people live better lives, to help give them a chance to manage their own wellness. And so I always want to kind of go back to that, back to those basics. The difference between a medical and a recreational consumer is a recreational consumer will think about consumption method before they think about need state. Rather than think about, oh, I need help with sleep, they might think, I want to try an edible. And it's incumbent upon those in the industry, whether you're a bud tender, whether you're an executive, to start educating everybody about why you should be using different products, how you should be using different products, what it means for your own personal wellness, what are you trying to solve? These are questions we need to ask people. Yeah. And so I will say, since we've gone from medical to recreational in so many states, and my state went in 2020, we have seen a lot of that greed coming into the industry. And one of the things I say to people, because I get a lot of people who reach out to me and are like, I'm interested in cannabis. Can you talk to me for an hour? I think it's really exciting and I want to be part of the industry. And my first question to them is why? Yeah. Why do you want to be part of this industry? And when I hear, well, that's the next new consumer product. It's going to be the hot new place to be. It's where all the money is. I step aside, because what I tell those people is, if you think this is where the money is and you think this is a green rush and you're going to get rich quick here, you are in the wrong place. If you come here, you'll be incredibly frustrated. You will work harder than you've ever worked in your life. I have never had a job this hard.
Right.
Whether I worked for the MSO or I worked for myself, I actually went to a doctor not long ago. And he's like, it was hard for me to schedule the appointment. It was hard for me to get in because my schedule gets so crazy. And I was running in there and I'm like, I'm sorry. It's just been super nuts. I've been working around the clock. And he's like, you cannabis people, you always say you're working so hard. And he's like, I have another patient from Cresco. And he's saying the same thing. And I'm like, I will tell you that I agree with your patient from Cresco. This is the hardest thing I've ever done. Every day in this industry is a challenge. Every day you wonder when the bottom's going to drop out on you. You never know what's going to happen. So you have to have a true passion for this, a passion for the plant and a passion for the people that you are serving. And yeah, it doesn't matter where you sit in the industry, you are serving that medical patient.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that because it's 100. I think we did the service naming it recreational. I think it just should have been adult use, and anybody that's mm-hmm. old enough gets their product for whatever purpose. It's not recreational to me. And the product selection changed also because medical patients are not getting their specific blends of, you know, 1-to-1s and 4-to-1s and all that other stuff because we're trying to get as many concentrates on the shelf as possible. It's you come into a dispensary now compared to what it was years ago, and it's like, oh, I can dab with 100 different products, but where my, you know, therapeutic tinctures kind of thing, they're lacking a little bit. I wanted to ask you about a go-to-market plan and a strategy, because I know a lot of, you know, I've hired and agencies and CMOs and all that stuff, and worked as a consultant in different environments. And this go-to-market strategy is always been sort of a thing where you go through the same thing. Like you were talking about, let's look at our profiles of our customers, and I did this in years ago in the consulting industry. It's always the same thing. What's your approach, and what's different in the cannabis industry and what's important in a go to market strategy and go to market plan? What would you advise people that want to engage with you? How to start that process?
Well, first and foremost, I still approach this the way I would have in CPG. I go back to basics. What I find happens a lot in this industry, but I also find it happens with entrepreneurial CPG brands too, is someone has an idea. They get really excited. They hire a designer because they want to see it come to life. And they have that designer build them a logo, or they have them design packaging for them. But what they haven't done is the brand strategy work. Who is your target consumer? Who is that audience? Who's that prime prospect, the most difficult consumer to delight? Have you built that person out? Is it Anne, or is it Josh, or is it whoever? You have to build out who that person is. You have to build out your secondary and tertiary consumers, so those outer rings of the bullseye. And then you have to go into your brand pyramid. How are you like other brands? How are you going to be different from other brands? Those two differentiators are where I feel a lot of cannabis companies go wrong. They think because they have a cool package, that's a differentiator. That's a marketing differentiator. Or because, you know, maybe they have a famous person who's associated with it, another marketing differentiator. But what you really need is true product differentiators. What makes your product unique? Don't just be another gummy out there. What makes you interesting? Up through your brand promise, what you're promising consumers every time they interact with your brand, the consumer response that you want to get from them, all the way up to your brand essence, which I think is the most important part of any brand, which is going to be, how do you want the consumer to feel? People don't remember what you tell them, but they will remember how you make them feel. Yeah. And so to me, getting that right is the most important thing. And then going into your positioning, your guardrails, your architecture, mission, vision, core values, and brand voice. It doesn't take a lot up front, but you have to do it to ensure that you have everything cohesive. If you don't do that piece, how you're going to activate your brand, which is going to be marketing, isn't going to work properly. So then you have to think about, as you think about go to market, once you get your brand strategy, and then you can provide all of that content to a designer, because a designer is only as good as the content they're provided, then they can put together the right look and feel for your brand. And then once that's ready to go, then you can activate it. Are you going to do digital, social, PR, out of home? What kind of insights are you doing? Activation, communication. And you develop your marketing plan from there. In the cannabis space, it's much more complicated, at the same time, much more simple than other industries. It's complicated because I can't go on TV and just sell cannabis. and I can't do paid social, all the things that other brands can do. But it's more, but it's simplified because I know exactly what I can do.
Yeah,
and my options are limited.
Totally makes sense. And I'm glad you brought up the emotional connection. And also, like, I'll ask you if there are any brands who are doing it right. Because it's so difficult to create a brand in the cannabis space. And you brought up gummies. Well, I mean, one gummy compared to another gummy, how are you going to differentiate that? Okay, well, we have Nano. Well, you know what? We all have Nano too. Now what? Well, it's flavor. That's preference. So it's like branding these products, you know, how do you differentiate one from another? And is anybody doing it right that you think are, you know, a good brand out there?
So there's a brand I love out there. It's called Miss Grass. Kate Miller, who is their founder, one of my personal heroes, she started out bud tender, involved in the industry, sat on the front lines. I always tell people, if you want to get into the space, becoming a bud tender is a great way to do it. Because even if you don't want to be on the retail side, you don't want to be a bud tender, getting that interaction with the patient and consumer really gives you an amazing perspective on the industry and on different products and branding. Mm. And so she did that and then spent, I think, 2 or 3 years building up her brand strategy, her product assortment. She really took the time to understand consumers, to understand what they wanted, and to put together the right platform. And that is one of the faster growing brands in the country. I think she's done a great job of really holding to her voice, creating her differentiators, and marketing in a way that's incredibly authentic to both her and the brand.
Yeah, I would agree. That's a really good brand that stands out, not only shelf, but it actually sort of serves a purpose. You know how many times I've had conversations with people and are like, man, I don't smoke a full joint. Maybe there's a half a joint. Let's create a dog walker or whatever it is. You know, have those products available. It's really, really smart. And there's not a lot of that. We feel everything is already done, but you know what? Maybe not everything is already done. Maybe there are some innovative products and then repositioning a product that may already exist or there have been like half gram joints and forever. But how do you take that and say, okay, now we're going to associate that with an activity that evokes an emotion. You know, here you go. Here's a way to be able to present.
So that's occasion-based marketing. Mm-hmm. So one of the issues in cannabis is we have a very nascent consumer. And a lot of times they don't know how and when they should be consuming cannabis. And as long as you can connect it with an occasion, so there's brands that have focused on the happy hour. Okay, so when it's the happy hour, this is what I should have. Is it, you know, sleep? Is it, you know, a social event with friends? You know, if you can connect it to something that a consumer understands, it's going to be really effective. You know, when we started in the space, we had Indica Sativa Hybrid. Like that was the framework. And I remember going through assortment planning and that was what we were looking at. And, you know, Indica Sativa Hybrid was created as a framework for the industry to help consumers understand the category. So in other industries, we've got like good, better, best. We've got other types of frameworks that help consumers understand what they should be buying and how they should be buying it. So we started with that. We have now found that that is not the right framework for the industry. And so we're evolving into terpene profiles and major and minor cannabinoids. And so we really need to think about how we're structuring that so consumers understand and they know why certain terpenes should work better for them, why certain minor cannabinoids will work for them. And really create that framework so consumers know what they should be doing.
If only there was like a DNA test or something you could take to determine that.
You know what? I think that would be brilliant. One of the things we talk about is we can't see your receptors. So when it comes to alcohol, we have an idea of how it's going to affect you based on height and weight and age and sort of your history of whether you're a heavy drinker or a light drinker. But with cannabis, it's completely different. And so you can't see someone's receptor. So you don't know if certain profiles are going to work for them. It's a little bit of trial and error. And so having something out there where we would be able to understand what is truly going to work for that consumer would be pivotal.
Yeah, I think one of the mistakes the industry made and needs to learn from and kind of shift away from is the naming convention that we give to our products, like the names of the chemical, the strains, the chemical varieties. I mean, Grandma Mary isn't going to go to a dispensary and get Alaskan Thunderfuck. I mean, it's ridiculous that we
have wife.
It's ridiculous that we create these names and it's confusing. And yes, what we do, and I love what you said, your mentor said, what we do today will dictate it. And that's something that we need to actually look as an industry and say, we need to be able to categorize these products differently and use the terpene profiles, use those effects, you know, this is more this, the, and then color code those and make it easier for the consumer to go in and say, all right, this is my green shelf. Cool. These are the products that are aligned with me. This is the blue shelf. This is, this is for Lori. It's better for that kind of thing. So we need to start looking at that. And I think the industry is injured right now. It's trying to get out from, you know, what happened, you know, pre-COVID and what happened in the industry and the funding drying up and all that stuff. So the innovation is trying to slow down. So I think that's the next step in the industry is trying to say, okay, let's see if we can start recategorizing and changing the way we communicate. Because I'm seeing this happening in other places in Europe, in South America, because they don't have this background of, the way the United States did. So they're looking at it completely differently and trying to categorize, you know, their cannabis differently based on those effects marketing, as you mentioned.
Right. And so, you know, cannabis, what I always say is it's the most personal industry out there. Mm-hmm. Everything we do in this industry is personal. And so we have to really understand the personal side of it. Like I think I've said to you, you know, other industries, people say, it's just business. No. In this industry, we would say in other industries, it's not just business either. It's always personal. But in this industry, it's truly personal. You're dealing with people's health and wellness, their body chemistry.
Yeah.
This is a very personalized space.
Yeah.
So how do you ensure that consumers are getting the right products for them? How do we make sure we categorize them so they're going for the right things versus what we think they want?
Yeah, it's exactly what you said. And thank you, by the way, because the name of my podcast is Everything is Personal. My book is Making Cannabis Personal. So I'm obviously in agreement with you that it's all about personalization. That's one part of it, is setting it up that way. The second part of it is getting the feedback, understanding the feedback. So because we're limited with clinical trials on human beings, mm-hmm. we're not limited to observational feedback, to actually getting back the data from individual consumers and now using AI to be able to interpret that data and start categorizing people based on those things and aligning everything together. So that's sort of the next frontier, I think, in this industry to move us forward.
Well, that's already started. I mean, I've seen more platforms coming out that have those reviews, the ratings, getting consumers to actually talk about a product and how they felt from it. How did it affect them? Did they like it? And all of that is primary consumer research. And where we have been hamstrung in this industry is primary consumer research. So in other industries, we see focus groups and surveys and in-home use tests. some of that can't be done in this space because it is still federally illegal. And we are not able to just run a focus group and have everybody try something. But we still have to find ways to do primary consumer research. Otherwise, we're never going to truly understand our consumer. And so when we think about, like, there's primary research and then there's secondary research. Secondary research is going to be a lot of your data that's coming in. And you need to be able to marry the two of them together to get a full perspective.
I completely agreed. That's where I think it's the next iteration of this industry and, you know, companies like ours and other companies are doing. Okay. So I have a few questions that I ask all my guests. Difficult to answer. So I'm just kidding. Please describe your first experience with cannabis.
Oh, my first experience with cannabis. I was in high school. And I had an older boyfriend who had gotten some cannabis. And we were outside in a park in the freezing Chicago winter, passing a bowl around in a circle, all freezing cold. And I remember trying it and coughing and then eventually kind of getting the hang of it and liking it. And I did it a fair amount in high school and college, but then had to stop because if I had been denied gainful employment because of a failed drug screen, my father would have killed me.
You didn't have all the, you know, the urine cleanse, all that stuff to beat one of those
No.
Tests?
And he was very clear with me that I needed to get a job out of college.
Right.
And that would be unacceptable.
I understand. Okay. So a couple music questions. Do you remember the very first concert that you ever attended?
I do.
What was it?
Besides Ella Jenkins back when I was a preschooler, I really liked, in college, I went to see Bush.
Okay. Gavin Rossdale.
At what they called the Rosemont Horizon, which is now the Allstate Arena, here in the Chicagoland area. And I went with some friends from school. And that was my first big girl concert.
What was your latest?
The last concert I went to? Oh, that's a great question. I think it was Enrique Iglesias. Mm-hmm. My husband loves Enrique, and once Enrique fist bumped him, and I don't think he washed his hand for like a month. We've gone to see Enrique Iglesias a few times, and my husband absolutely loves it. But I would tell you my favorite concert, if you're asking.
Yeah.
Was Kid Rock and Bon Jovi. When I worked for Jim Beam, they had tickets because we sponsored Kid Rock. And we went to see that at Soldier Field and it was amazing.
Yeah, I've seen Kid Rock and Bon Jovi before. So yeah, it's a very entertaining show. All right, so in the second music question, and I'll ask the question a little bit longer to give you some time to think. Now, the question is, if you could listen to five albums for 1 year, what would those albums be? And you don't have to mention like the name of the album. It can be it's a Kid Rock album if you don't remember the name. But what would be those five albums?
Bon Jovi for sure. My Chemical Romance. My favorite song ever is by them. Let's see. I really like the Beastie Boys. Madonna. Oh, the fifth one. I'm going to go with the Bangles.
All right.
I am definitely a product of my upbringing.
Yeah, great list. What has cannabis meant in your life?
it's meant a lot in my life. It was truly life-changing for me. So like I told you, when I came into this space, I felt like I found my place in the world. I had never been a cause-based person. I was always bottom line. It's all about the numbers, all about running the business. And I'm not saying that it isn't, but for the first time in my life, I found myself truly caring about a cause, truly caring about helping people live better lives, and really felt like I was connected to something bigger than myself. And cannabis gave me that. And I would say that it transformed me as not only a professional, but as a person. So if you had known me prior to cannabis, you would say I was very balls to the wall, very driven, very linear in my thinking, and everything kind of had to be a certain way. Coming into the cannabis space, it brought out a whole new part of my personality. So when I was at Forefront and I was developing our brand strategy, we made our brand essence love, because we wanted everybody to feel safe, supported, and loved when they interacted with our teams and our stores. And I developed Lead with Love culture, which I've taken with me out of Forefront, and I still utilize across everything that I do. And I believe that leading with love is one of the most important things that you can do for not only your business, but for yourself and for others. And leading with love is really about creating loving leaders. So I define leading with love as being selfless, doing something without the expectation of anything in return, positivity, approaching every situation with positive intent, and always assuming positive intent. And then having a strong moral code, doing the right thing, even when it's hard. We always have those choices we can make, the easy way or the right way. And I believe leading with love is doing things the right way. And in order to truly lead with love, you have to love the people you lead. Truly love the people you lead. And I think our world would be a better place if we did that. And that's what cannabis gave to me. And that is what I hope to give to others across this industry and across other industries, is to show them that we can truly be a safe, supportive, loving industry that is focused on helping people live better lives and doing the right things by our patients and our consumers.
Love that. It's a great answer. I really, really love that. And I can connect to that. All right. So bonus question, please describe what your room looked like growing up.
Oh, you'll love this. So when I was 6 years old, my parents told me that I was going to get wallpaper in my room and that whatever I picked, I better like all the way through college. And if I'm being truly honest, that wallpaper is still in my bedroom in my parents' house. And so it was pink flowers all the way down the walls, very 1980s. And I had a pink bedspread and I had little shutters on my windows to match my pink bedspread and pink curtains. And I had for the longest time, I had a hot pink and orange shag carpet, which every time I did anything like with beads or with needles, and as I told you earlier in the call, I was very artistic and did a lot of jewelry. So I was always using needles and beads. If I dropped anything on that rug, God help you if you could find it. And I'd always drop a needle somewhere and then freak out. I was going to step on a needle. And then my parents eventually got me a new carpet and I ended up with a pink regular carpet, but very pink. And it still looks exactly like that. I had white wicker furniture.
Very girly. That's funny. Lori, where can people connect with you, engage with you and your services, you know, social, whatever you want to share?
So you can find me on LinkedIn, Lori Parfit. Please follow me, engage with me. I would love to talk to you. My website is www.lkpimpact.com. Or you can email me at Lori, L-A-U-R-I-E, at lkpimpact.com.
Lori, thank you so much for joining us. Great. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To check out more great cannabis podcasts, go to podconnects.com. Here's a preview of one of our other shows.
Hi, my name's Kate, and I'm your host of the Pot Moms Podcast. I started the Pot Moms Podcast, well, because I wanted to end the stigma against using cannabis, specifically with moms, but also anyone who chooses to consume. I strive for a balance of humor and education, along with some pretty rad guests, to help combat social biases that come with consuming cannabis. Kids are hard. Join me for regular podcast episodes packed with parenting hacks, real life stories, and of course, my favorite cannabis products. The days are long, but the years are short. So roll another J and take a deep breath. Keep blazing and stay amazing.